Over now to Liberty Hall for an arena special as part of the International Literature Festival Dublin. And you can watch this programme online on rte.ie/culture.
Hello and welcome to this special arena from the International Literature Festival Dublin. We're here in Liberty Hall in the centre of Dublin. Away, alone, alast, along the river run that is the River Liffey. The theme of this event and programme is Books for Life. We had planned to speak with Naomi Wolf about her book, Outrageous: Sex, Censorship and the Criminalization of Love, but unfortunately she has missed her flight to Dublin and so is unable to be with us for this programme. However, we're delighted to welcome to the stage the best-selling author John Boyne, the author of 11 novels for adults, 6 novels for younger readers, novels published in over 50 languages. His 2006 novel, probably one of the best known of those younger readers, The Boy in the Striped Pajamas, sold over 5 million copies, worldwide bestseller. His latest book is called My Brother's Name is Jessica, which is about a trans girl and her family coming to terms with her identity. And John has stepped in at the last minute, for which thank you very much, John. Also with us, Juan Gabriel Vasquez, the winner of the 2014 International Dublin Literary Award, at that time simply referred to often as the Impact Award. And this was for his novel, The Sound of Things Falling, a book which traces the origins of the drug wars of the 1990s in the author's native Colombia. His current book, The Shape of the Ruins, once again mines the history of Colombia for its themes. This time, it's two political assassinations 3 decades apart, with the author himself appearing as a central character in the book. And French-Norwegian poet Caroline Bergvall, whose work takes the form of both published poetic works and performance, and that performance frequently involves sound-driven projects. Tomorrow in Smock Alley Theatre, in fact, as part of ILF Dublin, Caroline will present a conversation performance called Conference After Sweeney, which takes as its starting point the epic poem Bwile Hivna, and will feature a singer and visual artist, an ornithologist and sound artist, a medievalist, a geographer and sound recordings of birds in migratory mode. I am looking forward to finding out how you get all of that onto one stage in Smock Alley Theatre. Please welcome all 3. I suppose before we get into the specifics of the books that you've chosen that are might be referred to as books for life or books for your lives, I just wondered if there were a hierarchy of people or places or experiences or events in your life, if you could imagine that you loved having hierarchies, where would reading appear on that hierarchy of experiences? Juan, how high up, how low down, how much in the middle?
Oh, very much at the top, yes. I think reading comes, or rather writing comes from reading. We are, first of all, readers who are passionate about the experience of sharing the lives of people who had never existed. And then we become writers, probably because we want to give a little bit back of what we've taken from literature in as readers. And for me, it always was a way of, or rather I've realized this with time, it was always a way of being in the world. It was, I grew up in a difficult moment in Colombian history. I was a child when Pablo Escobar murdered a Secretary of Justice, thus opening a very difficult decade, which ended only when he died. The decade in which I became a teenager and then an adult. If I hadn't had books during those days, I think I wouldn't have been able to cope with the whole thing. In books, I found this kind of refuge, a way of discovering that humanity was not all lost, and that there was reason for hope, in the sense that in books. Refilled the glass of humanity that was being lost every day with the killings and the bombings and the senseless violence that we had to live through. So it was very important.
And I'm wondering, because you studied law originally, you're working as a lawyer, what role did books play during that period? Were you, in fact, reading lots of fiction rather than case studies?
Yes, don't tell my parents.
Various legal articles.
Yes.
Don't tell mommy and daddy?
No, tell mommy and daddy, no. I discovered that law was not my true calling at the middle of my law studies. So what I did from then on was just sit in the back and read Borges and Camus and the Latin American boom. And I spent a lot of time in the secondhand bookstores in downtown Bogota looking for these books on these people instead of going to civil law and commercial law and all that stuff.
Student who
I'm very
go
proud
to
about this.
Yeah, sure you are.
Yeah.
Student who didn't go to lectures, not that unusual, I guess.
Exactly.
Caroline Bergvall, what about that hierarchy for you, Caroline? Where does reading sit in it?
Reading sits very high up in a specific way, in the sense that reading is really a storage house of manuscript culture or codified culture, graphic culture. It can lead, for me, it also leads on to other models that are either models of writing or models of performance, or ways of thinking about these artifacts in different ways. So it's a fundamental part of memory, of types of history, but it's not all for me in book forms. You know, you can find them in sculptural materials, and that's also reading. You know, you have a lot of work now which uses other materials that are part of graphic culture.
Which might explain some of the things that are part of your event, of which we'll talk further about. But you clearly think of reading, it's not just about reading words on a printed page. Mm. There's a lot more involved than that.
It's never just reading words on the printed page, I think. It's always, there's often a silent articulation. And of course, reading used to be allowed. So it's not far from there to say that reading leads to sound. And that I'm very interested in that. But, you know, there is definitely the sense that when we learn to read, we learn aloud, we spell aloud, and then that gets absorbed, in our culture anyway, gets absorbed back into the reader once we master reading.
And how quickly, or at what point did poetry become, because poetry is, I think, central to your current practice, at what point did poetry become an important part of your reading, apart from the rhymes maybe that you might have said as a child? Was there a point when you started reading poetry printed
Absolutely.
On the page?
Very early on, poetry, like you say, fundamental way of organizing sounds. I love the structure of poems. I'm half French, and I was trained in a French-speaking schooling. And for me, works like Baudelaire or even L'Outremont, and then later on pieces that would sort of carry for me the possibility of what poetry can do, continued on into English when I then sort of started moving my work into English.
Half French, and your father, I think, is from a German.
Norwegian.
He's Norwegian, and
yes.
There's a German background in there as well, is there?
I was born in Germany, but that was a, you know, yeah.
And your English is clearly working very well. How many languages are we talking about?
I speak three, if you like, languages, official languages, and then I speak the languages that one speaks, which is all the types of slangs and incoherences that one also, you know, has. But yeah.
And I guess you speak poetry as well, because that's
what I mean. Yeah,
its own language. Yeah. John Boyne, I wasn't really expecting that one of you was going to say right at the very bottom of my hierarchy, actually. So I'm guessing that it's pretty high up on yours too.
Yeah. Well, when I my phone rang about an hour and a quarter ago, asking me to fill in here, and I was reading a book that was so good that I was a bit sort of fed up that I had to jump in the tackle.
Consider saying no.
What were you reading?
The new Joseph O'Connor novel.
All right.
Which is amazing. It's so good.
Which I think we'll be talking a little bit about with Joseph O'Connor on Monday's programme.
Oh, it's...
You have
it's
to tune in.
I think it's the book of his career. But anyway, so right at the top, because right from the time I can remember as a child, both reading and writing have been completely connected. They've been... most of my days when I'm at home would be, you know, spend an hour writing, then maybe read for half an hour, then go back to the writing, and then, you know, it's I split between the two, and there's always that question of if you had to give one up, the reading or the writing, which would it be? And, you know, it would be such a tough call to do that. But I think my life, as most writers' lives are, I guess, is built about around reading.
Yeah, and Juan mentioned to us, you know, how for him, reading was in some ways an escape from the difficulties of Colombia's difficult history, particularly in the 70s and 80s, is what you're talking about, essentially there, Juan. You have spoken widely about growing up as a gay man in Ireland and growing and as a young gay boy. How difficult was it to fit in there? And did books, did it form, not to provide you, not just with an escape, but maybe an explanation of the world that you couldn't get somewhere else?
Well, not entirely, I have to say, because I don't think as a young kid I found that many books on that subject, even though I was looking for them. I think it was more about being quite shy as a kid and quite introverted. And because of that, I kind of lost myself in libraries and books and writing. I don't think it had anything to do with like sexuality. I think it had to just do with just a lack of confidence that I had at that particular time in my life.
Julius Caesar, a play that, in fact, you're speaking about as one of the... And we'll accept it as a book for life or a play for life. What was it about... Were you reading Shakespeare, by the way? Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. Were you reading it in translation? Or what were you... When did you first read it, Juan Gabriel?
I started reading Shakespeare. My acquaintance with Shakespeare came through Macbeth, which I read in school. I attended an English school in Bogota, and so in fifth grade we went through Macbeth. I think with absolutely no success for the rest of my class, but I found the thing enthralling. And this is the beginning of something. Shakespeare has always been. I've always thought that it's just a strange accident that he is a playwright, because his plays have the. A certain kind of language that is, for me, nearer what a novel does than what playwrights were doing at his time. And I think one of the great speculations we can do is imagine that he discovers Don Quixote, which was published in 1605, a decade before he died. And he says, well, this is what I was trying to do. But I hadn't discovered how to do it. Julius Caesar is the one I chose because it has a lot to do with my last novel, but I could choose another one any time of day. But Julius Caesar is a story, it's I think the greatest meditation literature has come up with about political conspiracy and about political murder and why it happens and how it happens. And I was writing a book about two political murders, and at some point during the writing of the book, this image appeared to me that ended up on the title. And it's a scene in which Anthony looks at the body of Julius Caesar, who has just been killed, and he says, "Thou art the ruins of the noblest man." And I thought, this is what is going on in my book. These are two noble men, two people who maybe wanted to do the right thing, who were murdered. And so the shape of the ruins is a reference to that.
The two men that were murdered in the case of Colombian history that you tell, Jorge Gaitan, who was assassinated in 1948, and then an earlier execution, or assassination rather, in 1914, Rafael Uribe.
Yes.
Maybe just give us, you know, the pen picture of Uribe, first of all, in 1914.
Yeah. Yes.
Why that assassination was so important in terms of Colombian history?
Well, it was important, I think, because for me it was important because it represented a MO, let's say, a modus operandi that would repeat itself during the whole of the 20th century, and it has certain points in common with most political murders that have shaped the history of any country, the JFK murder or whatever. Every country has its own traumatic moment of this sort. Rafael Uribe was just a liberal congressman who was a veteran of several civil wars. I always say, you know him, even though you don't know, you know him, because he is the model García Márquez used for the main character in 100 Years of Solitude, Aureliano Buendía. So it's an really a universal figure, the guy who wants to do the right thing and he gets killed because of trying to do the right thing. As a civil war was ending in Colombia and he wanted to join a certain kind of peace movement, or rather negotiate with his opponents or his contradictors. Gaetano, on the other hand, is, we think of him as our JFK. It's the great figure who represented a certain kind of hope for many people, who was murdered publicly by a sort of lone wolf, and then the assassin was murdered, and we all agree that the assassin was murdered to shut him up, so that he wouldn't tell on the people who actually authored the whole thing. So it's one of those conspiracies that shape the life of a country because of how many lies are, we have inherited about them, because the version of history that we have grown up with is distorted or imperfect or has a lot of shadows, shadowy places. And I've always thought one of the things literature does is shed a little light on these lies of history, or rather fill up the voids of history.
And had you always linked the two murders, the 1914 murder, the 1948 murder, in your mind, or was it something that came much more to the fore as you wrote The Shape of the Ruins?
Yes, it did. The two crimes were linked for me through a very strange experience that I had, and that is told in the novel. As my twin daughters were being born, I met this doctor in Colombia who knew about my fascination for the crime of Gaitán, first of all. And so he invited me to his house, and he opened a drawer, and he said, I want to show you something that nobody else will be able to show you. And it was a vertebra of Jorge Eliezer Gaitán with the hole of one of the bullets that killed him. And then, without even giving me time to faint and recover, and he took out a part of the skull of Rafael Uribe Uribe, broken by the hatchets of his murderers. And these two bones just sat before me, and I knew I was going to write a novel about that. But then I had to find points in common. Mm. And this is how I discovered the strange way violence events tend to reflect each other or talk to each other or assume the same shapes. Mm. And it was fascinating to see how similar they were to other big murders in the history of countries.
And in the midst of all of this, you're in Bogota, having planned to be back in Barcelona for the birth of your twins.
Yes.
But the births came earlier than expected, in the 30th week of her pregnancy.
Yes.
In Bogota. Mm. And you're off looking at the skull of a murdered man and the spine of another murdered man.
I'm taking these bones in my hands and then going to the hospital to take my girls in my hands. Washing my hands beforehand, don't worry. And so this is really the birth of the novel. When I think, how will my girls inherit past crimes? How does violence, this legacy of violence in my country, is it carried down generation after generation so that it will shape in some way these newborn girls? And what can I do as a parent to protect them from the legacy of violence that is my country's?
And the writer, or the narrator of the novel, is a man in precisely the situation,
exactly,
the situation that you, the man sitting in front of me,
yes,
was in at that time. Is it you, that narrator, or is it some kind of fictionalized version of you? Because lots of the biographical details match exactly, and indeed the events around the birth of the twins match exactly.
Yes. I did use my life and my experience in that moment, my memories of that moment, and my anxieties about that moment very closely during the writing of the novel. There is fiction, because this is what fiction does for me. It takes life and gives it a different order so that it can extract meaning from events in a much more significant or you know, clear way. So there is a fiction thrown in, but the story of and the experiences of this character, Juan Gabriel Vázquez, very closely resemble mine.
Alison Sings, which is a book that you are currently working on, Caroline Bergvall, What do I describe it as, a long poem? Do I describe it as a book? What do I describe it as?
It is a long poem, book-length poem, based around Chaucer's Wife of Bath. So trying to rethink that iconic proto-feminist voice of the Canterbury Tales with the humor and the exaggerations and the emphasis that she has in the way she tells the story and asks the story about the relations between men and women and the role of marriage and the significance of love and marriage and the role of women in society from that. So I've thought, or I've always sort of, I've written already pieces that are working with Chaucer pieces, working with the notion of a moment in English, which is with Chaucer going to be shaping it into what becomes modern English. And it's still also inscribing itself within a culture, manuscript-based culture, in which, therefore, a lot of the tales are both written but also read aloud. So for me, the medieval period is a very rich period that sort of is very inspiring to a lot of my practice. And the work that I'm presenting at the festival, based around Sweeney, is, of course, an Irish sort of medieval poem as well. But to go back to Alison, the premise of that voice was to try and rethink the developments and the battles and the struggles that are taking place today, influenced by the richness of her voice and by the slightly more expansive and yet always under threat ideas of human rights that women now also sit within, which they wouldn't have done, you know, in medieval period. So there would, for me, there was that sense of trying to set up a sort of a cycle of voices based around the Wife of Bath that trace up a number of different female writers, but also more perhaps gendered writers, so writers that are sort of consciously aware in the way they play with gender, whether masculine, feminine, or other genders, if you like. So,
and when Juan was speaking there about, you know, taking the history and I'm making a very easy summary of, you know, fictionalizing it. When you think of that character of, you know, the Woman of Bath, do you think of her? Cause I keep saying, oh, yeah, that's an historical character, but she's an invention of Chaucer.
Yes, she is.
So is she a literary thing? Is she an historical thing? How do you view her? And does that change how you approach her?
It's very interesting. I view her as a literary figure, but in many ways you could say that the way she has been viewed, often with a sort of mixture of admiration and condescension, condescendence, for me is very much allowing me to develop a type of voice that I then use to write my Alison, if you like. But certainly, the way she thinks about marriage, the way she then looks at even her role as a urban woman, if you like, of medieval Chaucer time, is also very interesting socially. You know, she is calling to attention the discrepancies between men and women in their public role, in their private lives, and the way she can or cannot sort of seduce and or run her own household. And I find that sort of very sort of dynamic way by which Chaucer, in a very complex way, wrote up this female figure, I thought, for me, is it sort of doesn't matter if it's absolute social accuracy. From my point of view, I'm not a medieval scholar, but it is definitely very enriching to have so much detail from Chaucer of the behavior and the enthusiasms, if you like, that Alison, Wife of Bath, displays in that long piece of hers.
But in the way Juan describes, you know, taking the history and then but writing a fiction,
sure,
you take that literary character from Chaucer and say, that's all very well, now here's what I want.
Yes and no, because it's not all the fiction. I mean, you know, these characters were based on social relations. He was also basing them on a lot of other literary works, and there had just been a big sort of scandal with Christine de Pizan regarding sort of early feminism, so, and Jean de Main's scandal. So, you know, these were all things that were in the air, the notion of misogyny, the notion of female autonomy, these were in the air, so Chaucer is picking up on that. So I think from that point of view, we have also, in a sort of fictionalized and very dynamic form through Chaucer, we also have a very nice commentary on the relation between men and women as seen by his character, but also as seen by so many of his own readings. What he was reading also finds its way, as we know, in the Canterbury Tales, but also through the voice of that wonderful character. So for me, the idea was, how do I pick that up and then bring it, perhaps not just up to date, but spin it? So I do a lot of work around notions that she might not address explicitly, but which might be very much in the wind of medieval literature, like, for example, Ovidian metamorphosis, transformational sort of love affairs, if you like, violent. And I sort of bring those to bear as well as part of a landscape that is very present in medieval literature and that we can find again now in relation to the whole idea of the transformation of identities, trans, etc. So, you know, I set up links that are rich and still very, you know, very much contemporary to our own questions. So it allows me to do that.
John Boyne, one of the choices that you made for us, John, in terms of a book for life, was John Irving's Cider House Rules. Now, one of the links that I see particularly in with Juan and the presence of that surgeon doctor who in real life you had this relationship yes. with and brought you off to see the skull and the spine of the two men and quite the two assassinated politicians. One of the links I see there, John, is the fact that you, I think, would refer to Irving as a mentor for you. There's quite a strong relationship that has built up over the years. Now, I don't know if he's ever brought you in and showed you a skull or a spine that have sparked off a novel.
He's probably going to show me his Oscar.
So that might have sparked a novel. Yeah. Would it?
Well, actually, it's interesting because in with the two that you're talking about, Julius Caesar, I studied that for my intro cert, and the Chaucer, the Canterbury Tales, I studied that for my leaving cert. But I'm coming a little bit more contemporary with John Irving's books. And I started reading John Irving when I was about 15, I think, and started with The Cider House Rules. And it was the first time I think I had read, it was at that point where I was moving from sort of teenage fiction into contemporary adult fiction for the first time, and discovered this big 600-700 page novel that just spoke to me in a way that nothing I'd ever read before did. And you know, it took on so many aspects of life. There was, it's a very political book in its way, because of course it deals with abortion and deals with the orphanage that Dr. Wells runs. It deals with the young abortionist Homer Wells, who is brought up as an orphan to take Dr. Larch's place, but doesn't actually want to be an abortionist. It deals with a lot of, as most of John's books do, with what he calls sexual misfits. And at that age, I felt very much like a sexual misfit. And when you look back at a lot of his books, they're so prescient, because even in The World According to Garp, which was published in, I think, 1978, so he would have been writing it around 76, 77, and that has a transgender character in it, the NFL football player Robert Muldoon, who becomes Roberta Muldoon. And that was John's kind of breakthrough novel. And to write a novel like that, I think, in the mid-70s, when that would not have been something that people would have been talking about a lot, would not have been necessarily the kind of commercial book that a young writer is going to want to have to, you know, to break through. It took a lot of bravery on his part. But he's continued that through the years. You know, he's always written about characters with gender issues. He's written about the AIDS crisis. And as a heterosexual writer, you know, it's extraordinary that this has kind of been his thing all the way through.
And would that have spurred you along or helped you in any way when it came to writing your most recent, it is your most recent publication, My Brother's Name is Jesse?
Yeah. Yeah, it's something I thought about. You know, I thought about different books that have been written over the years on the subject of transgender like that, and say, Myra Breckinridge and Myron, you know, Gore Vidal's books, who, and, you know, there's a number of them, but not a huge amount. I think it's a subject that people are much more talking about now than back then. But the other aspect, I think, of John Irving's books, though, that captured me outside of those issues was as a young guy who was thinking, maybe I'd like to be a writer, maybe this is what I could do. These big books, following a character from birth to death, which he does so much, you know, this big, I like a big epic kind of 700 pager, you know, I love that. And the whole story of a life. And Dickens, I've always loved, you know, I grew up reading. The first things I read around 11 or 12, when I actually left the kids department in the library, was the orphan books. you know, Oliver Twist, Nicholas Nickleby, and things like that. And John, of course, is very much a contemporary Dickens. Like, he's often compared to Dickens in his work now. So, yeah, I mean, his books have definitely influenced me right through my life. Coincidentally, the very first time I met him was here. He was on this stage.
Here in Liberty Hall,
back in, I think, 04 or 05, with Miles Dungan. And I was out there, but we'd already communicated quite a bit, and we went for a drink after it. And it occurred to me as I was sitting here, this was the first
time. Well, the way life comes around, yeah. back around on itself.
You're listening to an Arena special coming to you as part of the International Literature Festival Dublin. We'll be back with more from John Boyne, Juan Gabriel Vasquez, and Caroline Bergvall after this break. And welcome back to Friday's Arena, coming to you from Liberty Hall as part of the International Literature Festival Dublin. With me on stage here in Liberty Hall are Juan Gabriel Vasquez, Caroline Bergvall, and John Boyne. I just want to go back a little bit with you, if I could, Caroline. I wanted to talk about Audre Lorde and Sister Outsider. Mm-hmm. Maybe explain what that set of, it's a set of essays and set speeches of from the right. 70s and 80s, 70s, thereabouts, yeah?
That's right, yeah.
Explain what that is.
Yeah, that is, it's a book that has been re-edited recently, like most of her work has now come back and been republished. I think she's an extraordinary figure, calls herself black, lesbian, feminist, poet, warrior, and was all these things. Led an open gay life from the 50s on and wrote about it very early on, but then also started to use her personal history as a way of thinking about broader processes of injustice that she then puts into her work as well. And Sister Outsider is a collection of really magnificent essays that are all call to action. And these calls to action are about primarily come out of silence, primarily speak your truth. So it's very much, I think, very appropriate to our times that her works are being republished at the moment. She died very unfortunately of breast cancer, and again, she wrote about that in a very open and quite painful way. And again, in that, there's also the way she manages to think about illness in ways that are not just about things that might isolate us, but also bring us together in a different way. So I wanted to bring that book and her voice to the books of life, because this is another, for me, another type of work of literature, which is the one that gives you courage, the one that inspires you. I found when you have an essay called Silence Will Not Protect You, and then she describes why silence will not protect you with all the courage it means to speak at different times her truth and the many truths of her life. That for me is extremely inspiring of how we can then keep on thinking together. How do we come out of isolation in order to rethink the collective, in order to rethink how we share all the difficulties we now also face in our contemporary times, if you like. So,
And this idea that silence will not protect you, you know, Sister Outsider, I can see how that would feed directly into Alison Sings, which we're going to get that in the autumn, so I presume it must be practically completed at this stage from the writing side of things.
It's coming out in the autumn.
So I can see how that would, how that particular reading would feed directly into that, and you probably revisited it. But do you remember when you first read it, and maybe the specifics of, you talked about it, that was a book that is all about having courage and that it encourages bravery. Can you remember the specifics of an early reading and maybe how it fed into giving you courage to do something?
No, I really can't. The exact moment of reading Sister Outsider, I can't remember. It's been a book that's been with me for many years. I have early copies of it. I suppose it's one of those books. I can't remember when I first read it, but it is one of the books that, having read it, it accompanies you. You know, having read it, it changes you. And that's why I wanted it there. But I couldn't tell you exactly. Of course, it's to do with my personal life experience. It is to do with my own processes of coming out and the way I might feed that into my work, what that might mean in broader terms as well of my practice, working with historical materials and then thinking about the contemporary. So all that, of course, feeds into it. But the exact moment, no, because it's continuity. It's the flow that keeps on inspiring.
Do you remember when you, I think, John, it's safe to say, are you a big fan of Gore Vidal?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you remember a first reading or an early reading of Gore Vidal?
I think it was the historical books, Burr and Lincoln, maybe when I was about 17, 18. Again, those big 600, 700 pages. But then I read a lot of Gore Vidal after that. I remember when Palimpsest came out, I was working in Waterstones in Dawson Street, and I got really into his work and his wit and his the way he seemed to hate everybody, yeah. You know, and could just write about that. He was such a bitch, basically. And I think he's a lot of fun to read. He's a lot of fun to watch on documentaries. I guess you're asking because of A Ladder to the Sky.
Yeah, exactly. Which was your last book.
Rattles. Yeah, my last book, Rattles. I have a big long section on Gore Vidal in that. And watching the documentaries to kind of capture his voice was fun. But I always compare it to, it's like trying to write a scene with Oscar Wilde in it, that you've got to really lift your game. You know, you need every line that comes out of his mouth to be a total zinger.
Better than he would say himself.
Well, you know, it wouldn't be better, but it'd be, you know, you try to at least, you know, get close to it. Mm. So that, you know, if he was still alive, that he could actually recognize himself in it.
Putting an author into the book like that, as you did, you're quite right, I am thinking of A Ladder to the Sky. Putting Vidal into that, an homage, that's what was involved there, yeah?
Yeah, because in that book, I mean, it's about a malevolent, aspiring writer who kind of charms and seduces everybody around him. But there's only one real living figure in it, and that's Gore Vidal. And I wanted one person who would see through this character and who would, you know, not fall for his nonsense. And I just, you know, when I thought about it, I thought he's the one. He's the one who will never sort of allow himself to be treated like an idiot.
And to what extent then, I mean, in A Ladder to the Sky, we're kind of talking about a bitchy style relationship and a young author who, I don't know, is it fair to say he manipulates the older author? There's a question around.
Well, they kind of manipulate each other in some ways, because the young author is trying to use the older guy for, you know, to advance himself, to get a step up that ladder. And the older guy is using him because he's kind of kept his emotions locked inside for 60-odd years, and suddenly he pours them out. But it's not really Gore Vidal who inspired that book. It's actually, it's a second lesbian writer, actually. It would be Patricia Highsmith.
I was going to say, to what extent did The Talented Mr. Ripley lead into all of that?
Yeah, The Talented Mr. Ripley is the thing that led me to it, because those five books, the Ripley books, are some of my absolute favourites. And what always amazed me about those books is to take an anti-hero and for the reader to, if not approve of what he's all the terrible things he's doing, to be still on his side sort of all the way through, that you kind of want to see how bad he's going to get, and you don't want him to get caught. You know, when you see those five books of it, you want him to kind of keep doing terrible things and for the reader to kind of stay with them. And that's a difficult thing for an author to do, because a character who is so bad, so evil, like Tom Ripley is, or like Morris is in my book, that usually the audience would be opposed to them and like not like them at all. But they have to have, if they have some charm, if they have some seductive power, then I think the audience kind of stays on side.
I brought up the Gore Vidal mention there because I wanted to talk about it with you then, Juan Gabriel, Joseph Conrad. Because here's an author who you have a dialogue with in your novel. I'm not sure that it's quite the homage that we get in the case of in the case of Gore Vidal and John Boyne. Maybe just to set up what we're talking about here, if you tell us about Joseph Conrad's Nostramo and how it relates to your own novel then, The Secret History of Costaguana, I think we'll get a sense of how you feel about this part of Conrad at any rate.
Yeah, well, the novel tries to dramatize...
This is the Conrad novel.
Yeah, The Secret History of Costaguana is a book I published 12 years ago in Spanish, and it came out in English about a decade... No, 6 years ago or something like that. And it springs from the unconfirmed fact that Joseph Conrad might have visited Colombia when he was 19. He was part of commercial ship that traveled to the West Indies to bring things. He was 19. He was just discovering himself as a young sailor. He made part of this tripulation and he went probably to the Colombian coast. There's reason to believe through his letters that he did so. And the thing is, he wrote, years later, he wrote this wonderful novel, Nostromo, about a fictitious Latin American country called Costaguana, full of civil wars, where people are killing each other all the time, and where there is this this province called Sulaco, where they have a particular kind of richness, which is a silver mine. And so because they have this and because they want to protect this, with the aid of American warships, they go through a revolution and they achieve independence. It's the exact same thing that happened in 1902, 1903 with Panama. Panama, I don't know if you're aware of this, was a part of Colombia. And they have this particular kind of richness, being the place where it would make more sense to build an interoceanic canal. And so because of this, the United States saw an opportunity. They supported a revolution. They sent their warships. And Panama ended up seceding from the rest of Colombia. And this is a huge national trauma for the country. And so there was a novel about this, Nostromo. And I found it fascinating. And my book is a sort of picaresque, humorous exploration of the whole situation, in which Joseph Conrad could not have been the role model and the novelistic master that he is for me in my real life. He had to be taken with a grain of salt, and so the character makes fun of him, and so every single nasty thing about his life is put really on display, because it wasn't supposed to be a homage. Novels like this one do not pay homage to anybody.
Yeah, it's because I'm interested to hear that in the midst of that. So Conrad clearly is, you say, they're a kind of a novelistic hero too.
Yes.
But there he was, taking the history, the story of your country,
yeah,
and messing about with it, to yes, say the least. Were you annoyed? That you, that's my story, get your hands off it. Was there a bit of that going on?
My character was annoyed, which is good enough for me. My character was
unfortunately
furious.
Yeah, unfortunately you didn't put yourself into that book.
No, exactly, I'm not there. But my character asks a question I think is deeply important in any society. Who has the right to tell our story? Are we willing to renounce that right? Are we willing to give somebody else the right to tell our story? And this is a very big political question. And so the whole reflection behind the novel is this. The idea of taking back control over our own narrative as a country is something that is deeply important for any country.
Well, you might then, since he is a novelistic hero as well as a character that one of your characters has a lot of fun with,
yes,
in one of your books, is it Lord Jim in particular that makes him the novelistic hero?
Yes, Lord Jim and Heart of Darkness are two books that have been of such a great importance for me that I really think I would have stopped writing some years ago if I had not discovered these novels. They're important for me because they work as discoveries, as investigations. There's this character called Marlowe, who is a kind of stand-in for Conrad, who is dealing with somebody else's life, with a material that he doesn't know about. So the actual telling of the story reflects the position we are in as readers. We seem to be discovering the story as Marlowe discovers it. And I thought, this is how I feel about Colombia. Colombia is, for me, a dark place, difficult to understand, whose history, whose politics are difficult to understand for me. And so using this literary strategy was the way I found to deal with my own country and literature, to try to write about it. And it was absolutely important for me to learn of this strategy, thanks to Conrad.
We'll be back with more from Liberty Hall after this break. And welcome back to Liberty Hall and the final part of our programme from the International Literature Festival Dublin. Still with me are Juan Gabriel Vasquez, Caroline Bergvall and John Boyne. Caroline, tell me a little bit about what you're doing tomorrow at Smock Alley. Poetry is way too small a word for what you're at here. But
What attracted you to Willa Hivner for the type of conversation performance that you're going to give tomorrow?
Yes. It is quite an unusual format, what I'm trying to do. It is to try to bring people from different disciplines around one book so far. This is my second discussion of this kind only. The first one was around Attar's Conference of the Birds, and here now it is around Sweeney. As seen by Heaney, so it's Sweeney Astray, so it's a slightly shortened but a really, really beautiful version. Mm. And it was really to think about his deep historical material, early medievalism. Questions of birds are questions of flights, questions of travel. My interest in the idea of travel, migratory patterns that birds follow, what happens in relation to human society and migratory patterns. A way by which birds have a very dynamic collective speech life, song life, which we can recognize with human speeches as well. And in general, therefore, connecting also remembering that poetry comes from song and has song. So all that, all in all, is the basis, if you like, for those types of conversations. And I then was in conversation with the festival, the International Literary Festival here regarding a... manifestation, if you like, of it here through the character of Sweeney, who gets transformed and cursed into birdness, if you like, can never recover his state and yet is often in conversation with the humans. So there's a lot of contemporary things around interspecies connections, environmental issues that are there, the beautiful traveling over Ireland that he's doing in his desolate state. He still travels across Ireland with all the landscapes and names and his favorite trees, you know. And so for me, there were so many elements there that are conducive to a sort of cross-field conversation with a number of people that I then invite to be thinking about through their field. So you mentioned a geographer, there's a medievalist, there's an Irish singer, a poet. Through their fields, through their interest, to think with me, to talk with me and our audience around the themes that might emerge. And the thing...
As well as all the people you've just, an artist you've just mentioned, there's somebody else involved. And rather than say who he is, yes, let's hear his work.
These are actions that show passage. Materialize transit into events that transpire. That vanish as they take shape.
And that's a little section there from Conference After Sweeney that Carolyn Bergvall and pals will be presenting tomorrow. What were we actually listening to there, Carolyn?
You are listening to what starts to happen with the human conversation as Rob Lazy, my collaborator, musician, wonderful sound artist, starts to treat our voices by thinking about or listening to our frequencies and start to transform the conversation into a sound environment so that we all then get transformed, if you like, into sonic, purely sonic beings in the course of the discussion.
John Boyne, the final choice that you had for us is the go-between, I suppose, an old man looking back. This is something that you have used, I think, in your own writing. I suppose it is a fairly common thing to have, this idea of looking back at the story. Why the go-between, the L.P. Hartley novel?
Well, you know, one of the questions that writers get asked a lot, and usually the answer usually changes, is what's your favourite novel? but... I'm pretty consistent on The Go-Between being my favourite novel. I just love that book. And it has the two things, I think, that I've written about the most. Either children, in terms of these kind of lonely, isolated kids, which I write a lot about, and Leo Colston is that very much during The Go-Between, and these very elderly men looking back on their lives filled with regret and wondering why... they did not take the chances they may have taken, which is Leo as the older man looking back in that book. And I've in most of my adult books, they're not most of them, but a good portion of them, The Absolutist certainly, and History of Loneliness, it takes that idea of the old man looking back with regret. And then the children's side. It's also the most beautiful story of first love and how somebody's heart can get broken. And the boy in that book, you know, is being used, as I'm sure many of you will know, by the farmer next door and the older sister of his best friend as a to pass letters back and forth between them. But he thinks, of course, this older girl loves him. And when he discovers the truth, it shatters him. Shatters him so much that he can never form a relationship again for the rest of his life.
And I'll finish up with you, Juan Gabriel, and Milan Kundera, and the art of the novel. I think, has this got to do with one of the central ideas, I think, in your work, how small lives, intimate moments in lives, are actually shaped by forces of history and politics? Is that why Kundera is so important to you?
Yes. There's a great sentence in that little book, The Art of the Novel, in which Kundera says that the novel's reason for being is to say things that only the novel can say. And this is important for me because, I'm writing about the history of Colombia and I'm writing about historical episodes, but what I find interesting, what I try to build my novels around is not exactly the historical novels, but rather the way they affect private lives and private human beings, which is the universal aspect of those historical moments. The reason they can, I hope my novels can speak to an Irish reader or Chinese or South African, is that the novels deal with that part of historical events that is not public, that is private, that has to do with our intimate lives. And this is what novels can tell you that no history book will ever tell. So those ideas that Kundera explores in that little essay were essential for me to try to understand what I was trying to do.
Is history kind of bad fiction? Is that what you're telling me?
No. But I do believe that when we write fiction about history, we should try to say some things that are not in history, that history is unable to tell because it doesn't have the documents, it doesn't have the proofs, and that is usually emotions. Emotions, intimate lives, private lives, the way public events out there will shape our behavior as lovers and brothers and sisters and fathers and sons. This is what is interesting to me, and this is the reason that I can reasonably say that my novel will tell you some things.
Well, you've certainly told us lots, the three of you, over the past hour or so. That is it for this evening's Arena. Thanks to Juan Gabriel Vasquez, whose book The Shape of the Ruins is published by Macalhose, to Caroline Bergvall, whose book Alison Sings will be published in the autumn, but whose event, Conference After Sweeney, takes place tomorrow at 8 p.m. in Smock Alley Theatre, and in particular to John Boyne for stepping in at the last minute and being so kind for us during this this programme. John's most recent book, My Brother's Name is Jessica, is published by Penguin. Full details of everything happening at the International Literature Festival Dublin can be found on the website, which is ilfdublin.com. Research for tonight's programme was by Leah Murphy and Paula Shields. The broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon. Damien Chanel and Damien Gavigan were on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. I'm Sean Rocks. Look forward to being back at base Monday at 7. Right now, it's time for John Creedon.